For Greek nerds such as myself, seeing a commercial during the overhyped, exaggerated, and just really overplayed Super Bowl commercial string of things, having a commercial with Greek in it was kind of cool. I was like, wait a second, I know those words. That's our language, even though I'm not Greek. That's my story's literature. That's a part of, wait, I recognize that. Why is New York Life using words that are a couple thousand years old in order to prove a point about the word love? The first one was phileo, and we understand that to be kind of brotherly, sisterly type of friendship, type of love. And then storge is this understanding of familial love. Eros is this erotic love. It's this passionate love. And then, I hope you guys noticed in the commercial, the most noble of these, the most admirable of these, from a life insurance company promoting itself, the most admirable of these is agape. For God so agaped the world that He sent His one and only Son. I think it would do us all well if we took inventory of how much and how often we use the word love. The Greeks got it right. It's the reason they had four words for our one English word, love. I love Chipotle. I love my mom and dad. I love that movie. I love my wife. I love such and such sports team. I love Chick-fil-A. And some of you are like, yeah, I got a Chick-fil-A. Yeah, I admit that. I confess that. Our English word love has been sandwiched and squeezed to mean something that you really feel strongly about. We use the word love in more of an emotional type of direction. That's the way in which we send that word out from our lips. We feel strongly about something, so we use the word love. If we use the word like, we don't really like it a whole lot. We just kind of like it a little bit. But if we use the word love, that means we really, really, really like it. We use the word love to express something that sometimes is hard to put into a word. We use our emotions and our feelings, which matter. There's one thing that we're going to be continuously talking about this year, is that our emotions matter, our feelings matter. Some of us were raised to squash our feelings and to squash our emotions and to not necessarily to know that they're there, but to not release them, to not be honest about them, but to keep them boxed in and covered up. But our emotions matter. Our feelings matter. They change like the wind and can be mistaken often for bad Taco Bell, but they matter. But our emotions seem to drive the word love more than anything else. I think it would do us well to add the word like back into our vocabulary a little bit more often, even if it's awkward a little bit. I like that sports team. I like that movie. I really like that song. We've overused the word love. The word love can create this grip. It can create this attention-grabbing. There is a sacredness to the word love. It's just how special and unique the word love is. And unfortunately, it's been watered down to mean whatever we want it to mean. And it takes a Super Bowl commercial to wake us up a little bit to how sacred and to how special and to how powerful the actual word love is. Today's new series begins with what Jesus calls the greatest of all teachings. So if you have your New Testaments, I invite you to turn to Mark chapter 12. We're going to be looking at three verses, 28 through 31. And this is going to guide the direction with which we're going to be going with over the next 3 to 4 weeks. We're going to be talking about the Shema. the song that Jared just led us in. The first word of the Shema is here. The Shema is here. The Shema is listen. The Shema is pay close attention. The closest equivalent English word we have to the Hebrew word Shema is here. So you guys, just we as a church family, we sung and we prayed this prayer. Shema, O Israel. This is what Jesus calls the greatest of all teachings. The first place priority in being a person of faith is this, Jesus says. So follow along with me. Mark chapter 12, beginning in verse 28. One of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Jesus often got in these types of conversations, these debates. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, this teacher of the law asked Jesus, "Of all the commandments, which is the most important? Of all the commandments, which one is in your heart, Jesus? Of all the commandments, how do you interpret, how do you hear that commandment? Out of all of them, which is your first place priority, Jesus?" "The most important one," Jesus answered, "is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord alone." Now in the song that we just sang, we sang, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God." The word there is echad, and it can mean both one or alone. It's one of those dual meaning words. And the answer, which one is right? The answer is yes. It can be both one and alone. But for the original context, when the Shema was put into place back in Deuteronomy 6, which we're going to look at in a few minutes, it wasn't this theological declaration that God is one God. It's, "You shall love the Lord your God, the one Lord, the Lord alone." No one else. No other gods. The Lord alone. Love the Lord your God. The Lord alone. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind and with all of your strength. You give the Lord your God everything. You are all in. Nothing held back. Nothing reserved for yourself. Nothing reserved for anyone or anything else. You love the Lord your God with all of you. We're not necessarily going to be paying attention to the second one. The spotlight will be shown on the second is this, love your neighbor as yourself, on a later date. But for this morning and for the weeks to come, we're simply going to be shining the spotlight on this idea of all in. Loving the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind, and with all of your strength. You are all in loving the Lord. And my job this morning is to focus in on two words. The word hear and the word love. How Jesus responds to this question is exactly how every Jewish person should have responded to the question. Daily, daily, every morning and every evening, the Jewish people would recite the Shema. Every morning and every evening, they would recite the Shema. I'm going to say it again so you guys hear me. Every morning and every evening, they would recite the Shema. As individuals, or if they were in groups, they would do it together in groups. They get this out of Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 9. But before we get to that text, they would recite the word Shema. In our English word here, it doesn't quite give it all of its justice. It kind of gets at it a little bit. And Shema doesn't just mean to listen as if we're acknowledging that there are sounds and there are words, I hear you. But Shema is to pay so close attention that it impacts your life. In order to hear, in order to Shema, you are paying so close attention that it impacts your life. It impacts your mind. It impacts your thoughts. It impacts your behavior. There is this call of obedience that comes along with this understanding of Shema. I hear, but I don't just hear. I am moved to do something, to pay so close attention that it impacts your life. Very quickly, we're going to pay attention to where this comes from. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 through 9. Deuteronomy is kind of the second telling, if you will, of the Israelite journey from Egypt into the promised land. This is the second go-around. First go-around did not go very well, if you remember the story. They got there and they became afraid. So they had to do it all over again. There was another time of testing for the people of God before they were ready to cross over into the promise that He had given them. And a part of Deuteronomy is, what is life going to be like when Moses is gone? That's a part of the story of Deuteronomy. Is Moses is going away and Joshua is taking his place. So these are these last words, these are these last sermons, these are these last words of exhortation that Moses gives the people of God. And what is life going to be like for us once Moses is no longer leading and Joshua takes his place? And before you get into the nitty-gritty of the law, before you get into all the checklist, which eventually becomes 613 by the time Jesus rolls around, it begins with this. It begins with the Shema. Deuteronomy 6, beginning in verse 4. Hear, O Israel, Shema, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord alone. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, and with all of your soul, and with all of your strength. You notice Jesus adds what word? Mind. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. They are to be in your gut. They are to be in the center and the core of you. They are to be on the core of who you are. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you're driving around town and you get stuck where you always get stuck, at that blasted train that always seems to be there by U-Haul no matter what time of day I'm coming there. Little confession thing. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you go about, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. In other words, don't be ashamed to have these words all around you. Embrace yourself in them. Engulf yourself in them. Pursue them. Put them everywhere so that when you see them, your heart is moved to who you are and to who your God is. Pay so close attention that it does something to your life. For every Jewish child, they should have been raised with the opportunity of reciting this belief statement, this creed, if you will. And that's exactly what this is. It's a creed. And for some within Churches of Christ, for some within our heritage, creed has been given this kind of dark, dirty, not so good thing. But a creed is simply a belief statement. And we don't like to box things in, but that's kind of what a creed does. A creed boxes certain truths about a faith in. and anything that needs to be added to the faith, any practice, any demonstration of what this faith looks like is always judged, is always weighed against, does it fit into what we believe in? I invite you and I encourage you to go pay attention to what's known as the Apostles' Creed and to see how much of our faith lines up with that and how that belief statement has been going on for a really, really long time. And there's a reason for it. It's not as if this is the faith and this alone. It's a very quick-hand way of telling what the story is all about. And for the story of Israel, the Shema was their creed. And what Jesus does with it in Mark chapter 12 and in other places within the gospel is what Scott McKnight has coined the phrase as Jesus' creed. Shema, O Israel, love the Lord your God, the Lord alone. Love Him with all of you. And love your neighbor as yourself. Everything that we do in faith is weighed against that. Loving God with all of us, with all of ourselves, and loving our neighbor as ourselves. Out of the 613 laws, Jesus responds with this, Shema. The word here is clearly a complicated and tricky one. In the ability or even lack of ability to listen, to pay so close attention, is both a learned and a practiced discipline. It's both a learned and a practiced discipline. Parents, our kids are watching us in all sorts of different ways throughout our life of raising them. But one thing they're also watching is how well do we listen? Because they're going to model that. They're going to echo that. How well do we listen? It's both a learned and a practiced discipline. You noticed I put discipline in orange. I hope you guys also noticed that the word strength was in orange as well. Since I'm wearing this red sweater that some of you may be confused with a certain conversion to a certain local team, I wanted to make sure that I put orange on the screen as well. Strength. In our culture of distraction overload, we are the most distracted people in human history. Our ability to hear, our ability to listen, our ability to be present is of vital importance to pay attention to. Vital importance for us to take assessment. How do we listen? How well do we pay attention? How easily distracted am I? How many times is this phrase said in your household? What'd you say? And it's like, it's not what did, it's would, or would you, or would you say? It's a Southern thing. How it got up here, I don't have the slightest clue. We just eliminate the word did and just put would, apostrophe D, and would you. How many times does that happen in your house? Carrie's lost count. Carrie often said that I inherited it from my dad, who had this innate ability of being tone deaf towards women. And I've apologized profusely about that. And what'd you say? When it comes to your, mine, our relationship with God, how many times are we telling Him, what'd you say? How many times in a song, how many times in a sermon, how many times when God intervenes in your life and is trying to get you to pay attention, He's trying to get you to hear, He's trying to get you to Shema. And we look at our God and, what'd you say? What'd you say? There are these three things that I want to present to us. Desire, presence, and posture. And I've used these words before because I believe they matter. But this word desire, I think it begins and it ends here. There must be a want to within us. And it can't be forced and it can't be faked. But it can be pursued. If you were to look at yourself in the mirror this morning and answer honestly, you know what, God, I have lost that want to. And I know I can't force it. I've tried to force it and it hasn't worked. I've tried to fake it and it hasn't worked. But God, I want to have a want to love you. There must be a desire. What are your first place priorities in life? Is a good question to start with if you've lost that want to. What are your first place priorities in life? And oftentimes when we do this, we put out a list. Well, this is my first place priority, and this is my second place priority, and this is my third place priority. And they wind up switching roles depending upon the season of life that we're in. Am I the only one that struggles with this? But when you ask yourself the question, what is your first place priority in life? What you are asking is, what is at the core of who I am? When it is all said and done, who am I? What is my heart centered on? What is my first place priority in life? And whatever that first place priority in life, it echoes into the rest of your life. It showers over every relationship, over your job, over your behaviors, over your attitude. It impacts everything. So what is your first place priority in life? So often we give first place energy to second place priorities and second place energy to first place priorities. Set your heart upon pursuing after the Lord. For a heart that has not set itself upon pursuing after God first and foremost is a heart that has already put God second. Teacher, what is the greatest of all commandments? How do you interpret that? Love the Lord your God, the Lord alone. I love my kids and something fierce, but they make terrible gods. My wife loves me something fierce, but I really make a terrible god. My sports team that I like, have a weird obsession with, make terrible gods. Our movies, our shows, our phones, our tablets, you name it. We may like them, have a weird obsession with them, but they make terrible gods. We live in a world that worships family. And as I started this little run with, family is awesome. Family is a gift from the Lord. But family equals terrible God. Simply does. We worship technology. And technology is awesome. Some of you are alive today because of our technology. But technology is a terrible God. Sports teams, most of us in here have our favorite one. Make terrible, terrible gods. Instagram, Facebook, all these things. And we give so much first place energy to false gods and false loves. And I say this next line with a lot of humility. We give so much first love to false love and false gods. And there are times in our lives when we wonder why God seems so absent. We wonder why God seems so silent. Pay attention to where our desire is at. The second one is presence. And only you can honestly answer this. What distracts you? For presence, for being present with the Lord, what distracts you? What is really and truly and honestly getting in the way of you being fully present here during the small amount of time that we're together? What distracts you when you're at home, being present with whoever is there at work? Wherever it may be, what distracts you? And the third one is posture. I invite you to hear Psalm 40, verses 1 through 4. Passages will be on the screen. I waited patiently for the Lord. You know that posture, that presence It's in the first few words. I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear the Lord and put their trust in Him. Blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, who does not look to the proud, to those who turn aside to false gods. And then Psalm 40, verse 6. Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but my ears you have dug. My ears you have dug opened. My ears you have dug. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. This context of worship. But the image that I want us to see here about desire, presence, and posture is what is getting in the way of us hearing. And maybe some of our prayers need to be, God, dig out my ears. God, dig out my ears. When was the last time you prayed that God would do that? When was the last time you prayed, God, I want to have a want to for your way and for your will to be at the center and core of my life? First place priority that impacts and influences everything else in our life. And if you do it, watch how that impacts everything else. Watch how that flows into everything else. Second word that I want to spend just a few minutes focusing on is the word love. The Hebrew word is ahava. The Greek word is agape. This sacrificial love, this self-giving love. The Hebrew word ahava is packed with meaning. And today we are going to post a couple videos on our Facebook page that the Bible Project has done on ahava and on agape. And on Shema. And we encourage you guys to go and watch them over and over and over again. We can't express enough how well they are and how well done they're put together. But two directions that I want to take us in, and then our time will be up. First one is God's love. God's ahava. God's agape. God does not force anyone ever to love Him. For a love that is demanded is no love at all. God's love for everything and everyone is because love is who God is and what God does. I'm going to string through some passages real quick. In Deuteronomy 4, verse 37, because He loved your ancestors and chose their descendants after them, He brought you out of Egypt by His presence and His great strength. Because He loved. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be His people, His treasured possession, His Am Segulah. And I love that Hebrew phrase. His Am Segulah. The Lord did not set His affection on you because you were so awesome. Because you were the greatest thing ever. Not just since sliced bread, but since the greatest thing ever. The Lord your God chose you because, not because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. Next slide. But it was because the Lord, what church? Loved you and kept the oath He swore to your ancestors that He brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of King Pharaoh. Loved you. 1 John chapter 4, verse 7. This is how God showed His love among us. He sent His one and only Son into the world that we might live through Him. This is how God showed agape to us. He sent Jesus. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. And then verse 16. And so we know and we rely on the love God has for us. God is love. Whoever lives in God, whoever lives in love, lives in God and God in them. God is love. For God, love is His identity, it's His character, it's His action. Everything God is and does flows from His love. Even allowing, permitting humanity the choice to not love Him. But He still loves us. Romans 5, verse 8. God demonstrates His own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. God demonstrates His agape, His most noble of all loves, in this way. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And one more. Matthew 3, verse 17. Just as Isaiah 43 has been speaking to me lately, this passage from Matthew 3, Jesus' baptism, has been speaking to me lately. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, whom I love." Every single person who has put on Jesus in baptism, every single person who has put on Christ in baptism, every single person who has been baptized into Christ, this has been announced over you. You are my daughter. I love you. You are my son. With you, I am well pleased. I am so proud of you. And when you pay attention to the story, if the lining up of events has anything to do with anything, Jesus hadn't done a single thing yet. No teachings, no miracles. He's done nothing yet. And over His baptism, God says, "I love you. I love you." The second one is this: our love for God, which is a response, it is a call of the Shema. To love God with everything that makes us, well, us. God loves every part of us. Our hearts, our souls, our mind, and our strength. With whatever bit we've got left of our mind and of our strength, God is inviting us, God is calling us to love Him with everything because He loves everything about us. And He invites us to love Him back. Never forced, always invited. Jared, you can come on up, brother. I want to close with two definitions of love. Two definitions of love. Love is almost a term that is indefinable. It's really, really hard to jam-pack a simple definition of love that really kind of takes care of it all. But the first definition of love is this. Love is unconditional regard for a person that prompts and shapes behaviors in order to help that person to become what God desires. If you were to change the wording a little bit on this definition and see this as how God loves you, God has a love for you that is unconditional. Unconditional regard for you. Unconditional regard for a person that inspires, that moves, that transforms from the inside out, that shapes behaviors in order to help that person become everything that God wants you to be. And the second definition is this. Love is a rugged commitment to be with someone, to be for someone, for as long as it takes unto Christ-likeness. I really like that definition. Love is a rugged commitment. God has a rugged commitment to each and every single one of us. To be for us and to be with us for as long as it takes. Jesus' promise, "I am with you always." Always. Nothing can separate you from the love of Christ. Nothing. God has a rugged commitment to be with us and to be for us as long as it takes unto Christ-likeness. I have an assignment for you guys during this last song that we're going to sing together. In your bulletins, and I hope you have a bulletin, you'll notice these little circles. The circles are just some of the Bible Project kind of clip art that we've put in the bulletin. And then there's a cross in the middle with one line. Either during this invitation song, you don't have to stand. If you want to stand, you can. But if you choose to sit during this invitation song, you can sing, you can hum, you can be present as the song is going on. But during this invitation song, I'm inviting you and asking you to write one thing. In Luke chapter 18, when Jesus has this interaction with a rich young ruler, he says, I've done everything since I was a youth. And Jesus says, you lack one thing. One thing. Out of our hearts, out of our souls, out of our minds, and out of our strength, out of the four things, what is one of those that you can put down on that line beside the cross to say, God, I want to love you deeper here in this area of my life. I want to love you more with my heart. I want to love you more with my soul. I want to love you more with my mind. I want to give you more of my strength. I want to give you more of my will. What is the one thing that you want to give over to the Lord for these next few weeks? Where your prayer is, God, I want to love you more here. I want to have a want to love you more here. Whatever that one thing is, I invite you to write it down and to pray over it week in and week out as we continue to journey through the Shema. You can stand if you wish. If you need to sit, please sit. As we sing this final song.
I'm forgiven.